Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me for this very special holiday episode is returning co-host Roslyn Vastias. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, John. Hi, thank you so much for having me again.
Right. Now, Roslyn, you were on for the Tale of Two Cities episode.
Yeah, that is correct, about a year ago.
But you're in real life, you're a poet, right?
This is true, yeah.
Why don't you introduce yourself to everyone out there and tell a little bit about where they can find more about you?
Sure. I'm a poet. I live in Providence, Rhode Island. My first book came out in 2012. I forgot to pitch it last time. It's called Only Blue Body. I maintain a little tiny Facebook page for it where I just post when I have publication news, I'll post stuff there, but largely I use that to promote other things that are out there that are literary or that I find amusing or whatever. It's pretty not obnoxious. I try to keep it fun and not overly self-promotional. Do you want me to say anything about my relationship with this piece of literature?
Well, let's say what the piece of literature is first.
Oh, yeah.
This is Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales, which appeared in various forms, but was, I guess, codified in the form that most people know it in 1952 with a recording that Dylan Thomas made. So it's got an interesting history from the standpoint of a text. It was originally a series of talks he gave, and then an essay that he was paid for, and finally it was a recording he made when he came to America. And from thence it was transcribed and put into the book form that most people are aware of this. And again, poem or prose? It's a matter of conjecture, and I'm interested to know what you think.
Sure. I was thinking that myself. It's not quite a poem. It's more like a what we would probably call now a lyrical essay or like a very short memoir. But it has a lot of the things that we look for in poetry. It has some really great figurative language and some amazing sonics. And it's in that way, it's really compelling. And it also has, I think, some time stuff. So one of the things that I like about poetry is how you can kind of move across time and how you can treat time and compress it and elongate it and do all this fun stuff using the weird form of short lines or long lines. I've never really considered it a poem. I guess probably an essay using with poetic language is how I would call it, what I would call it.
Now, what's your history with Dylan Thomas?
This piece of work is, I don't know, it's like a touchstone in my family. My dad was an English teacher. This was a big part of our holidays. I think my parents have the record, maybe. So I remember hearing it on vinyl, I believe. My dad may have read it to me himself once or twice. One of his students saw the movie adaptation with Denham Elliott, which I think was made in, which came out in 1987, and then that became part of our holiday tradition every year to watch that. And then, I don't know if it's too early to say this, but fans of Ellen Raskin, who you covered in an earlier episode, you covered the Weston game, she did some woodcuts for an edition that was released. So that's something cool to check out.
Right. No, that's the new Directions paperback here in America. I think it was originally published by a different publisher in Great Britain, though. But yes, that was one of the mini books that Ellen Raskin designed and illustrated before she designed and illustrated her own books. So yeah, it's a great book.
So my relationship with it has been lifelong, and my dad, I think, let's see, in 2003, gave me the book and CD set, and that was through Holiday Press, I think that, or Holiday House, Inc. And so I listen to the CD every year as I drive from Rhode Island to Pennsylvania for Christmas. And I was listening to it as well in preparation for this podcast. So, this is a piece of writing that's been with me most of my life. Like, we quote silly stuff from it. We quote silly stuff from the movie. It's really like interwoven into my idea of the holiday even. So.
I come to Dylan Thomas from a background in interest in radio drama. I listened to a lot of, as I've mentioned before, of ZBS and BBC and CBC productions when I was a child, and there was there's a long tradition of literary figures in Great Britain writing for the BBC, and even to this day, people like Tom Stoppard write radio plays. It's still considered a very viable thing to do when you have a governmental agency that's paying for it. Dylan Thomas is famous for this. He's famous for the VNL Go Not Gentle to That Good Night, and he's famous for his long-form radio play Under Milkwood.
Yeah. So you heard that? You listened to that on the radio?
Well, I've heard various productions of it. There was a famous vinyl version of that starred Richard Burton that got released in the '50s. But even the version that I like best was one that was produced in the '80s. By George Martin, who was the producer of the Beatles recordings. He directed it, and it starred an all Welsh cast, including Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce as voices 1 and 2.
Uh-huh.
And then they had some crazy things like Bonnie Tyler, who was a Welsh singer, who sang Total Eclipse of the Heart, played one of the musical roles. Even Tom Jones sang a part for it. So it was kind of a crazy hybrid of Dylan Thomas with a bunch of Welsh pop artists from the 80s.
That is crazy.
It's hard to find that recording, but you can look for it if you want to. I knew him primarily from that. And there's a lot of ways in which A Child's Christmas in Wales is sort of a miniature version of Under Milkwood. They're both...
Yeah, I read it when I was in high school. I don't remember it very well, but I do remember reading it and, recognizing some of the sort of elevated poetic stuff that he was doing.
Well, part of what you were talking about, the strange things that Thomas does with time and with shifting points of view.
Mm-hmm.
In this piece, in A Child's Christmas in Wales, we move from personal memory to a sort of a dialogue between voices.
Yeah.
That's introduced out of nowhere. That, I think, is very grounded in his radio background. And both this story and Under Milkwood end with the town falling asleep and with the people falling asleep and with voices going into darkness. Now, in one sense, that's a cliche, but in another sense, that's the way in which Thomas has voices work. They sort of appear from the ether and they recede into...
Because he even talks at the beginning, like he starts the piece by calling the Christmases up, and he compares them to voices that he hears before he goes to sleep. So it's almost, and then the child Thomas falls asleep at the end of the book. So it's as if this whole thing is kind of compressed into those kind of dreamy seconds as you're drifting off to sleep, but you're not quite there yet. So yeah, that's an interesting kind of way of thinking of it. And he kind of pulls the Christmases, he pulls the memories out of like a snowbank.
That's the opening lines. Let's take a minute here to listen to them. Because they do set the stage for Thomas's project and his style.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases roll down towards the two-tongued sea, like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the fireman. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden, waiting for cats with her son Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, is white as Lapland, although there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats, sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slide and sidle over the white back garden walls and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared.
One of the things that strikes me right off the bat about Thomas, and one of the things he's most known for, is his alliteration and assonance. This is why it's a little bit confusing as to whether this is prose or poetry. It kind of moves in and out of a highly formal and elevated language that makes use of image and makes use of these poetics, and then it into something that's more like, I don't know, like a little anecdote or a little story. What's fascinating to me about this alliterative approach is that's an approach that's deep inside the Welsh poetics. That goes way, way back into medieval Welsh poetics, and we have this English tradition that comes largely out of Chaucer, and Chaucer got it from continental sources, basically French and Italian sources of metered rhymed verse, that the indigenous poetics of the Isles was actually alliterative. It was certainly that way in the Celtic tradition. It was that way in the Germanic. You should look up online about the Welsh tradition called Keng Haneth, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, but it's spelled CYNGHANEDD, and I love reading about alternatives to the Western metered rhyme form that feels so natural to us, because there's nothing natural about our poetics at all. There's like a million ways you can construct poetics.
Yeah, and I think, just if you're writing contemporarily, it's good to look at other ways of doing that now in poetry. End rhyme is a little bit, frowned upon these days. So you're looking for other supportive structures to make your poetry kind of ring nowadays.
But I do like what you talk about the way that Thomas in these opening lines is conjuring memory out of physical forms. He's pulling it out of the snow. He's pulling it out of the ocean. He comes from that highly abstract, dreamlike vision into an extremely concrete, humorous memory, like very, very silly memory about the cats and the fire at Mr. Prothero's house.
And it's like ridiculous. He uses this incredibly highfalutin language, and it's incredibly lyric and incredibly beautiful. And then he sort of plunges into this. He spends a lot of time crafting the imaginative world that the boys kind of live in, not just here, but like later when the boys come back, when they're caroling, or even when the narrator is out kind of roaming around the town by himself. And yeah, it's a strange contrast between the sort of the writer who's guiding us through the piece and the child who's in the piece and also has a way, kind of the language shifts a little. And some of the humorous stuff that I noticed was like the eternal snows, eternal since Wednesday. We were trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road. So he sets up this imaginative world that they're in, and then he sort of undercuts it very dryly. And even when they're first coming to realize that there's a problem with the house, the boys don't even perceive the Prothero's house as a house. He says, from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. And I just also like how the men in this story are so often shown as ineffectual, or just kind of big sleepy bears. Like, Mr. Prothero, we're told, like, falls asleep every day after lunch with a newspaper over his face. And then later on, that kind of comes back with the overfed, sleepy uncles who have to like loosen their collars in the parlor. And the women are portrayed as bustling. I mean, sometimes they're portrayed as being alcoholics or, you know, being timid. But it's just a really interesting. It's kind of a funny, charming thing that I noticed.
Yeah, I like what you say about the memories being both elevated and undercut. There's a way that this poem examines the way we make our own mythologies about ourselves. And for Thomas, Christmas is like this. I think for anyone who comes from a tradition where there are annual holidays of importance, there's a way in which those memories become these building blocks of identity. And it's hard to, because those memories are memories that quite often are on the verge of what is accurate in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way in which these things become our own origin stories and our own just-so stories about the way the world is and creation myths. And Thomas is very wry and ironic and, as you say, dry in this poem, or prose or story or whatever you want to call it. But he's also does succeed in creating this crazy world and having us inhabit it through the lens of his own memory.
Yeah, some of this, there's so much to say about this. Some of it's like I was thinking so much about the landscape and the interior spaces in this piece. We're moved like across the whole piece, we're moved inside and outside and inside a lot. And there's a lot of sky. There's a lot of, at the end, he says something about the one clouded sky or something like that, where the whole, and we know what that's like. The whole sky has been covered with one dense mat of cloud. And the sea is very present, and you get the sense, you can feel that they're on a hill. When he's talking about the postman sliding down the streets, he's talking about the tea tray slithered hills, where, and it took me forever to figure out what that meant, but it just means that kids go out and sled on tea trays. They're going down, but there's so much of this that, like, I remember from when I was younger, and it's only now as an adult that I'm even figuring some of it out. But to just circle back real quick, because I'm getting excited, so I feel like I'm missing, I'm not hitting the points I want to hit. The time structure, he never sets anything too much tied to any part of his life. You know, he kind of says that to us at the beginning. He sort of sets his intention when he says, I can't remember if it snowed for 6 days when I was 12 or 12 days when I was six. So we already know, like, we're getting something that's kind of through this scrim, and so he sort of ducks in. He'll give us specific memories, like he'll give us the very general thing. I think the cataloging of the gifts is one of my, I don't know, I want to say it's one of my favorite parts, but I have so many favorite parts of this. But it's just this plentitude of useful gifts and useless gifts. And that's part of the dialogue portion that you mentioned between the narrator and the small boy, who kind of helps him move that part of the story along. And then he'll kind of touch on a specific memory, like when they go caroling, something that really stands out because it was so terrifying to the boys. And around all of those things, like you said, around all of the incidents, is this scene setting. So oftentimes it involves moonlight and clouds and trees, and all of this tonal stuff, where you can kind of feel the whiteness and the blackness of the landscape together. And then he'll move us into these really, like, closed, comfortable, cozy spaces that are just kind of overflowing with relatives and food and music and warmth. Like at the end, when he's talking about them all singing together, he says the house was very warm. Like you can feel the heat of all those bodies together and all those people drinking and eating all day and just being together and being convivial. So that's another cool thing that, I mean, you can do in poetry a lot. And he does it here very successfully, I think, is kind of move from these big, wide open spaces where the boys are kind of doing their own thing as kids on Christmas Day with a lot of free rein, running all over the town, and getting into little, you know, mild bits of trouble, like harassing Mr. Daniel. But then there was something else. Like, I love how, so they go down to the sea, and the boys say, someone asks, can the fishes see it snowing? Which, I mean, whatever. I guess that's a pretty, like, typical kid question, but it struck me as so, like, wise in that sort of child way. Like, they're doing all these normal boy things and being, like, not bad kids, but just, like, rowdy boys. And then they're like, can the fishes see it snowing? Like, they still have this innocence in their repartee, in their back and forth with each other, which is, like, so endearing and so deftly handled. And it's funny because I don't think this is an overly, it's, there's a lot of sentiment in it, but it doesn't ever strike me as overly sentimental. And I'm wondering, like, how he avoids, like, why, what it is that he's doing that he avoids, feeling like treacly, I guess.
He does undercut things with humor and with wry observations. There's comedy between the way the adults comport themselves and what the children are able to perceive. The way in which he describes the uncles and aunts, the way he describes the Protheros, the way he describes the comings and goings in town. At the moment, it feels as though the narrative is going to come to a halt because he's reached the punchline of the little scene he's in. He pulls way back into this omniscient God's eye point of view that suddenly wheels us across the whole countryside and across time itself.
Yeah, the when he does that, like when there were wolves and whales, and the weird jawbones of deacons line, which I've never, like, I still don't get what the hell that means. Like, is that something? Is he just making stuff up, or is that like should I know what that is? Like,
that segment strikes me to be of a kind with what Thornton Wilder was doing in The Skin of Our Teeth, which was one of the very first episodes of Sophomore Lit that I did back in the day with Phil Gonzalez. The Skin of Our Teeth, if you aren't
aware of it. I read it in high school, though. I remember really liking it, but I don't know if I can remember it. But it's weird, isn't it? It's absurdist, right?
What it does is it takes this eons long look at humanity,
yeah,
and has things that happened in prehistoric times mixed with suburban life in the 1940s.
Yeah, I always wanted to see a production of it, and I think there was a recent production, wasn't there, maybe?
There's productions of The Skin of Our Teeth all the time, so you'll probably get to see one eventually. There was a wonderful one that was broadcast on PBS back in the mid-80s that starred Blair Brown, Sabina, and Jeff Combs played Kane. But in any case, what I feel is happening here is that, again, that myth-making that's going on there, because he's borrowing imagery from prehistoric whales, and particularly in this line he says, "And we chased with the jawbones of deacons the English and the bears before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback." There's a lot of jokes in there. You know, there's like the inversion, the Duchess-faced horse is an inversion of a horse-faced Duchess. But to talk about the jawbones of deacons, it's sort of like Samson and a jawbone. It's sort of like Paleolithic humans. He's referring to the wars between Wales and England. It's important to remember that Wales was also a land that was conquered by the Saxons.
Yes.
In fact, the name Wales itself is the Saxon word for foreigner, which is such a insult. It's an insult to come in and take over the British people's land and call them the foreigners. And it's also good to remember that King Arthur was originally a Welsh hero. In the very earliest Arthurian legends that exist were written in Welsh. There's one, a wonderful one called Culhwch and Olwen. And Arthur, the historical Arthur, if he existed, there's some evidence that there was a basis of this, was probably a Welsh warlord who fought against the Saxons as they invaded. So it's a little bit ironic.
Oh, how weird. So he was like appropriated, kind of, huh?
Exactly, yes.
Wow, that is crazy. I'm not sure I knew that. That's, John, it's always great talking to you. You're so smart.
I don't know that. I took a class in Arthurian legend back in grad school, but the although Wales has a less visibly fraught relationship with England than, say, Scotland, mm-hmm, or Ireland,
mm-hmm,
it still has been a fraught relationship.
Yeah.
And I apologize to any Welsh listeners out there if I'm getting your history wrong. Please do write me and correct me and correct all my pronunciation of Welsh words. So I feel like this is part of the marvelous way that he does this, but I think there is there is a pattern here of moving from section to section to section. It's not a very long book. I believe the recording is something like 28 minutes long. So you can comfortably sit down and just listen to it. In fact, probably you can find the recording of Dylan Thomas reading this on YouTube if you want to be really cheap about it. That recording has been in print continuously since 1952. And actually, it was credited with inventing the whole medium of books on tape because it was so popular. And so unexpectedly popular in its day to have a spoken word recording that became a bestseller for the company, which was Cadmian Records, that it brought about a sort of a vogue for doing this that has, of course, continued to this day.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to get. I think you can even get the vinyl for shockingly cheap on eBay or something. I wrote down some of the sonics that I liked, but I mean,
Thomas's language is remarkable, and if you read it and you don't read it aloud, you're doing yourself a disservice.
You should definitely listen to it. I mean, I would urge all of your listeners to listen to it first. You know, if they don't want to try reading it, I mean, it is a quick read. It's easy peasy. But hearing him read it is wonderful. You know, I read on Wikipedia or something that they thought that maybe he was drunk when he was recording it, but he doesn't sound drunk. He sounds very in control. And he sounds very familiar with the piece.
He was notorious for being drunk, as a speaker, and he was the kind of high-functioning drunk that meant that he could get away with it a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then when things went off the rails, they went off the rails really,
very
really badly.
Yeah. And there was one other thing I just wanted to touch on. The idea of sameness and not the same. I like when he, so the little boy, it's funny, right after that myth making, that's when the little boy steps in. So even then he's kind of undercutting like his sort of grandiosity by introducing that character to be like, well, it snowed last week. And Thomas says, oh, but that's not the same snow. And we all know what that's like, having an older person or even ourselves being like, oh no, the snow is just not the same as it was. Like, and I'm not even saying anything about climate change here, but like you have this romanticized ideal of the perfect snow. And the snow that he talks about, like, comes out of the sky and comes out of objects themselves. Like the snow just comes basically from everywhere. And then the later on, they're talking about the uncles, and Thomas says there are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And it's like this, like uncles are this unbroken force, that just extend forward and backward into time. And like, they are always there at Christmas, and you know exactly what he's talking about. Like, you know, if you've, I mean, even if you don't celebrate Christmas, if you've been to weddings, if you've been to any family celebration, you know who these guys are that he's talking about, and what they're like, and kind of what they smell like, and what they talk like, and how they, you know, how much they eat, and all of those things. But I will just get to the sonics. So of course, dumb, numb thunderstorm of white torn Christmas cards when he's talking about the snow. That black snow white belfries, he's talking about the church bells tugged by bishops and storks. Again, he's talking about the snow frozen foam of the powder and ice cream hills. So that's some of the stuff. Then I think what also is funny, like, is kind of the sentence texture, because he'll have, there's this line that for some reason my family and I say all the time, the dog was sick. It's just this very clipped short sentence, like after the celebration, the dog was sick, and then Auntie Dosie had to have 3 aspirins. And he does it at the end, too, when he's sort of describing what he does before bedtime. Like, there's this long sentence about how he's looking out at the town. Comparatively long sentence. So he's looking out at the town, and there's something so much that I remember so much, this feeling of being a child and also observing, like what was going on around me. So he's getting ready. Christmas is over, and he's getting ready to go to bed. And he looks out at the town, at all the lights, and he can kind of hear the music coming up, or he says he can. And there's this sense of kind of the writer inside the child, like looking at the scene, and almost marking it. And then it's just very clipped. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept. Yeah, it's just really masterful. I think this is a really good, if you're writing poetry or if you're writing memoir, it is a good piece to look at to see how you can shift quickly from scene to scene, what you can do with texture, sentence texture, what you can do with sound, even in something that's quote-unquote prosaic, how you can make it lyrical and make it beautiful. And hopefully, you know, do some of the things we talked about, like avoiding sentiment by shifting, by managing your scenes. So yeah, I think I've said everything I meant to say.
I do love that ending that you mentioned there. I do like what you say about it being very clipped, especially since the opening of this is very round. The assonance is so strong in the opening. Years around the sea town corner now.
He likes round sounds.
Out of all sound, except the distant speaking of voices. You can't say it without stretching your mouth. And then at the end, everything is very short and breathless. I turned the gas down, I got into bed. And what I really love is this line, I said some words to the close and holy darkness, because this is a little bit about the way in which I think Thomas avoids sentiment when he's dealing with highly emotionally charged things. You know, he's describing here is prayer, but he's describing it in a way that is, he's so reverential, he can't even mention God. He talks about talking to the darkness. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it becomes sort of pantheistic.
It's so private. And the whole piece is pretty secular, you know. But it does strike me that if you have a religious practice, that's sort of what it should be like. It's so enclosed and private. Yeah, we don't know what the words were. You're right. Like, he doesn't, it is pantheistic in a way. But that's almost a closeness of a God, like so close to you that it's not separate, like that it's not, you know, that it's not even embodied, kind of.
Thomas is almost synesthetic in his approach, in that he gives attributes to things that don't seem to match. You know, he gives sounds to tastes, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. things are making music that don't make music, and if you ever do listen to a production of Under Milkwood, I think he develops that even more. That Under Milkwood has longer passages that are more abstract, and that makes it a little bit hard to read. I think just as a text, it's hard to read. It works wonderfully when it's performed, but it may be difficult to get into as reading. But there is a line that he repeats quite frequently in Under Milkwood. The narrative voice that comes in and comes and goes throughout that play says, "Listen, time passes," and I think that is a lot of what he's on about, again, this is why I feel like this is sort of a miniature preparation for Under Milkwood, is there is this way in which you're asked as a reader to pay attention to something in a way that you can't really pay attention to. There's no way to hear the passage of time, and yet there is a way to hear the passage of time, and it is through this kind of this patchwork of memory. And that's one of the things I really love about Thomas, is that jumble of subjects and verbs that don't seem to go together, but he somehow gets them to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I concur.
Okay, so do we have anything left to say to the readers out there except to go out and read this?
Yeah, read it. Listen to the recording. Check out the cool album art. Check out Ellen Raskin's cool woodcut illustrations for it. The other thing, I can really highly recommend the adaptation. It is actually probably much more sentimental than the book itself, but I think it's a really well done adaptation. As I said, Denham Elliott is in it. He plays like this grandfather figure who basically is the narrator, and his grandson is the small boy. And then there's some sort of framing devices around it. But it's really beautiful. The child actor is amazing, and I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly. Denham Elliott makes a great grandfather, and it's just a really sweet, sweet, sweet thing to watch if you have kids, or if you don't, I guess. And yeah, it's a cool adaptation, and it really brings it to life. So, and at the end of that, in the credit sequence, there's some interesting woodcut art as well. So check that out. Make sure you check that out as well if you have a chance to watch that. Those are my recommendations.
Thanks a lot, Rosalind. And whatever you celebrate, I hope you have a happy one. And we'll see you in the new year.
Great. Thanks so much, John. I appreciate it.
Thanks to my co-host, Rosalind Vastias. Her book of poetry is Only Blue Body, and it's available from the Ahinga Press.
The reading this time was by Anthony Johnston. Find more about his many writing projects at anthonyjohnston.com.
Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write to me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join in the Facebook page, or look for me on the Incomparable membership Slack. By the way, I have a correction. In my episode on the Red Badge of Courage, I cited the number of Civil War casualties as 200,000, and astute listener Greg Della Posta tweeted at me that my number was way off. I went and checked this number, and he's right. The number of dead in the Civil War was closer to 620,000. There was also an indeterminate number of MIAs, and I think that this was what I was thinking of, because Walt Whitman mentions in his book Specimen Days 200,000 missing. I think the actual number of missing in action is not known, but is closer to 400,000. So numbers are fun, and history is fun, and check your facts, kids. Keep up the reading, everybody, and Happy New Year. Everything will be on the final.